The Science Roundtable is what we do on the first Monday of every month on this broadcast. And I'm glad to have in studio a number of innovative young minds from the University of Rochester, engineering students who are working on innovative solutions to real-life problems. And so let me go ahead and say hello to the students around the table. I also have a weird sort of echo in my... There we go. That's probably my own engineering mistake there. Let me go ahead and say hello to the students around the table. Colin Murphy is here. Colin, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Evan Baker is here. Evan, thank you.
Yeah.
Also here is Brittany Kilcher. Brittany, thank you.
Hi, thank you.
And Kara Lampson's here. Kara, thanks for being here.
No problem.
All seniors, guys?
Yep.
All seniors, engineering students with various backgrounds and various applications for what they're doing. Now, this past Friday was Hey Jim Design Day at the University of Rochester. That started in 2011 as a way for engineering students to demonstrate the innovative solutions that they've been putting together for real-life problems. And the students here have been doing that. And I kind of want to go around the table and hear about what they've been doing. And I want to start with Brittany Kilcher. We were speaking before the program about the work that you've been doing and the way it could impact a lot of people. So let me back up and ask you what your field is.
So my degree is in biomedical engineering. And so we were tasked to create a task trainer for OBGYN residents to practice a certain procedure.
OBGYN residents, and a chance for them to practice a very difficult procedure or one that's fraught with risk, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the procedure is going to help them do what?
So women who have a weak cervix, so the cervix is the part connecting the uterus to the vaginal canal, and women who have that have a short cervix or a weakened one are more prone to preterm deliveries or miscarriages. So one of the ways to prevent that is to place a suture around the cervix, basically closing it shut during pregnancy and then removing it at 37 weeks.
Okay, so we're talking about an issue that many, many women face when it comes to possible preterm delivery, possible miscarriage, but the procedure you're talking about is not necessarily a simple one, or at least there is some risk associated, yes?
Well, the difficulties with this procedure is that the cervix is pretty far down the vaginal canal, and so there's a very restriction of movement. So one of the problems is that they can't really have the movement that they need to place the sutures in correctly.
Okay, and how did you end up with this project?
So our professors, Dr. Lerner and Seidman, have connections with customers, and they bring them in, and we, all the students, listen to the customer propositions, and then we can choose which ones we want. So this was my top choice.
And why was this for you a top choice?
So I'm interested in medicine. I'm going to medical school next year, and this was one of the most relevant problems that they gave us that were really related to medicine in particular and residents.
Now, Brittany, you're a senior.
Yes.
And so you're 22 years old?
Yeah, I just turned 23.
You're tackling a problem that so many people face. And sometime over the next decade, when most of your friends and start getting married and having families, it's amazing how things change your perspective. You already have a very forward-looking outlook the way this could impact people. Have you stopped to think about the possible impact this could have?
Yes, one of our problems with the interior design was to really think about the constraints surrounding our device. And I was tasked with looking at the economical constraints surrounding our device. And so we were looking at how task trainers can improve healthcare and reduce medical costs, such as medical errors and how much preterm delivery costs and things like that. So just looking at the overall picture of our device.
Really remarkable stuff. And what's the timeline then for it, Brittany?
So we're done with the project, basically. We'll be delivering our product to our customer in the next few weeks. Yes, I think I answered your question.
Okay, you did. And that means that, again, residents will have a chance to practice before they have to put their work into practice in real, for lack of a better term, real life scenarios, right?
Yes, we actually had a simulation day, so that's where all the residents come together and they practice various procedures on different task trainers, including ours, and we already tested it and we had rave reviews. Everybody loved it and it was a huge increase over the formal model.
Okay, and before I move on to your peers around the table,
yes.
Let me ask you some ignorant questions about biomedical engineering. You know, you're obviously creating an innovative solution to a current problem. And biomedical engineering, I'm sure, spans the medical spectrum. I mean, essentially, is it engineering solutions to complex problems? What are the other things that you think you might do in your career? Have you thought about that?
Actually, no, not really. I'm really interested in cell and tissue. That is more my domain. So there are four different concentrations within biomedical engineering. There's biomechanics, optics, and electrical engineering. So I chose cell and tissue because I'm more interested in metabolism and how physiology. So that was more relevant to my interests.
Mm-hmm. And what happens next for you? You're done but not done.
So I'm done with this project. Well, this project is more or less done. We're thinking of perhaps bringing it to market, but there are still issues going on there. But we're talking about it. Otherwise, next year I'm going to start medical school.
Okay. Well, I hope that we hear more about the kind of work you're doing, because when we talk about practical application of engineering projects, helping people who are at risk for preterm delivery or miscarriage applies to a lot of people. Let me go around the table. Kara Lamson is next. And Kara, your engineering specialty is what?
So I'm majoring in optical engineering in the Institute of Optics.
And you are also getting ready to move on somewhere else. Going to Duke?
I'm going to Duke University for medical physics.
For medical physics?
Yes.
I know it. The word medical and the word physics mean, but tell me about medical physics.
So medical physics is basically radiation treatment for cancer patients. Hmm. I wanted to go more into the radiation therapy aspect of it, where you actually help plan the treatment out.
And why does that appeal to you?
I've always been interested in the medical fields, and I thought it was kind of related to optics in a way. When I did undergrad here, I got all the prereqs out of the way to focus on this, and it was very applied because it had aspects of both engineering and biology, and I like to bridge the gap between those two.
Well, and speaking of your project, pronounce it for me. It's the eye dominance detection instrument, right?
Yes.
Okay, I
yes.
had the wrong one. on optics. Eye dominance detection, how does it work?
So this device we made, it's very portable, and our customer is a LASIK surgeon, so he wanted this device to quantitatively measure eye dominance in humans in an efficient amount of time. So basically, we have this device where patients can hold this. We programmed an application on an Android device, and it shows you two stimulus, and then when they overlap in your vision, the two stimulus will keep switching between the eyes over time. And so we're collecting data points to see how much more time you spend on one eye over the other. And from this, you can calculate the dominance index. And this is a quantitative value that the LASIK surgeon can then use to figure out how much to correct one eye when he's doing surgery for some different procedures that they do.
All right, so you started to answer my next question, which is understanding very accurately eye dominance, what's the benefit? So when a LASIK surgeon mm-hmm. has to deal with our eyes and What will he use the understanding of eye dominance to do?
So in this
I say he or she.
I've
got a balanced table, by the way. it was a he or she. Go ahead.
Yes. So our customer, one of the procedures he does is to do induced monovision, where you correct one eye for nearsightedness, one eye for farsightedness, usually in older patients who have declining vision. And from this test, he wants to correct the dominant eye for farsightedness, so it's good to know which one is the more dominant one and by how much, so he knows how much to correct that one eye.
So it sounds like a problem that is relatively common.
Yes, it's very common. Nearly all humans have some degree of eye dominance.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And how has it worked so far? Update me again how the project is essentially done and what happens
yes,
next with it?
Yes, our project is done. We made the test down to about 5 minutes, but future improvements could be making it even shorter, just so it's more efficient in a clinical setting, and maybe just improve the application, make it more reliable and more repeatable. So we need to collect more data for that.
How is your own eyesight, by the way?
My eyesight is fine. I think I'm a little left eye dominant. But,
I was going to ask you. Now, if most of us have some degree of that, mm-hmm. I wouldn't know, I guess, offhand.
There are very simple tests that you can do.
Mm-hmm.
where you can just do it in 2 seconds and then figure out, just say, I'm left eye dominant or I'm right eye dominant, but it doesn't tell you by how much. So it varies from person to person, but there are simple tests that you can do.
Do we know if we wink with a right or a left eye, does that tell us anything?
I don't think so.
No?
Maybe one test that is common, though, is that you can just walk up to, like, a telescope or something, and then you'll usually choose your dominant eye to look through it at first.
Okay.
So just naturally, you'll go to that one.
Very interesting. Really neat stuff. Kara, have you thought about what you'd like to do in terms of, you know, down the line, you talk about cancer treatment and that kind of a thing. Are you in this field because it appeals to you, your skill sets? Do you think intrinsically about helping people in medical need? You know, what are the things that you think about?
Well, I think basically I've always been very interested in applied engineering. Mm-hmm. So I've always been interested in medical and biology. I chose optics because I thought I would be able to apply it in that medical setting. It's not emphasized in our program, but I was able to kind of combine the two by doing research in biomedical optics. And it's a big field, and there's a lot of good research going on there because light can be used in very effective ways for treatment of different cancers and a lot of different applications for it.
So. We've been talking to Kara Lampson and Brittany Kilcher, who are two University of Rochester students, engineering students who are using their own solutions to real-life problems, as you've heard. They've been lined up with actual problems that need solving, and they've been working on that. And they rolled out some of their work at HAGEM Design Day, which was this past Friday with the University of Rochester. And I'm going to get to your phone calls in just a second. I see the phone ringing. In fact, talking about eye dominance. Let me grab Michael in Brighton, who's called the program. Go ahead, Michael.
Go ahead. Evan, I'm almost 60 years old, and I only wear one contact because I just needed to correct my nearsightedness, and they figured out which eye was dominant. I wear one contact. The other eye allows me to be able to read close. A lot of people of my age have to wear reading glasses when they have contacts in because it doesn't allow them to read close, but I only have one contact. It allows me to do both, and the brain immediately switches from one eye to the other when you need to read either up close or see far.
Interesting. I have to say, this is how ignorant I am about optics issues, Michael. I have never heard of someone wearing just one contact. And I'm sure that's got to be somewhat common. Kara, what do you know about that?
I don't know much about that one-contact business.
You are not an optometrist.
I'm not an optometrist.
But does it surprise you, given what you study? I mean, it sounds like perhaps it's more common than I think.
Yeah, it's a very common thing, I would imagine, to correct one eye, because I know that the brain can just adjust to that once you correct one eye over the other.
Michael, how's it worked for you?
It worked wonderful. I need it in my work because I'm constantly needing to be able to see far away and see close at the same time. And otherwise, if I was wearing glasses, I'd be flipping my glasses on and off all the time, which I just found to be just a real problem.
Yeah.
So this has been wonderful. I think optometrists call it monocular, you know, just like mm-hmm. having a monocle.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. I just, you know, when I started hearing about you talking about eye dominance, clearly that's the case, and it really works if you just correct what you need to correct, you know?
Yeah, Michael, thanks for the call. And, you know, sort of a tangent on what Kara's working on, but interesting. I mean, you're making us think about things in a way that I had not thought about before. And I'm somebody who I think I was 33 or 34 before I realized I couldn't read anymore the way I wanted to. And now I can't kind of go at all without wearing glasses, but I can't stomach the idea of wearing contacts. So all of the different things, LASIK, you think about that, all the different options out there. Thank you, Michael, for making us think about that as well. And eye dominance is not an aspect that I thought about. So Kara, good work already.
Thank you.
Really cool stuff. Again, Kara Lampson's a University of Rochester student. So is Brittany Kilcher. They've been talking about their work that they presented at HAGEM Design Day this past Friday. We're going to get a short break and come back and talk to the guys at the table, Evan Baker and Colin Murphy, talking about their work using engineering to solve real-world problems at the University of Rochester. That's next on our monthly Science Roundtable. Coming up in our second hour, we're looking at the New York Safe Act, and we're looking very specifically at high-capacity magazines. The New York Safe Act made all high-capacity magazines illegal in the state, even those manufactured before 1994, which had been grandfathered in. But are gun owners selling or destroying or getting rid of their high-capacity magazines? We'll have that discussion next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from City Blue Imaging, a commercial printer based in downtown Rochester for more than 85 years, specializing in digital color printing, trade show, and special event printing. CityBlueImaging.com. And the Dolomite Group, saluting Villa of Hope. The agency offers trauma-informed care for youth and families in the greater Rochester area that are struggling with chemical dependency, mental illness, poverty, and neglect. More at villaofhope.org.
Welcome back to Connections, our monthly science roundtable. Carol Lampson's thrilled that I did not ask her for my own eye test. We were joking during the break that all the work that you do on optics, everyone wants to know what's wrong with their vision, which is a sign of respect, I think. It just, very interesting stuff that she's been doing. And before we continue our conversation about engineering solutions for real-life problems, Randy Gorbman is here, our news director. And we've been talking about the importance this week of hearing from our listeners and hoping our listeners become members.
And certainly it is an important way to do it, to talk about the kind of programming that WXXI gives you on a daily basis. So many folks, including myself, even before I came to work here, listen to Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Connections with Evan Dawson. I mean, Evan isn't one to blow his own horn, but I mean, he has just done an incredible job in a wide diversity of guests, a lot of great topics, tackling everything from poverty to the issue involving student busing to areas of economic development, environment, as well as arts and culture, and really that's the kind of thing that we need your support to continue. We have some interesting plans ahead for the talk show. Maybe even Evan isn't aware of those. We'll maybe do a few things.
Do you want to break any news here?
No, we're thinking about a few ways to maybe get the show out in a number of different ways. We're not going to spill too many beans right now, but it will take some support. And folks have been so generous over the years here, but I hope they realize it is really an ongoing type of a situation. You can become a sustaining member, give a little bit each month. You can just give a few bucks now if you can. Whatever you can do, it helps. You can do that at WXXI.org. That website is secure. You can enter your information there. Again, if you want to just do it on a one-time basis or 10 bucks a month, a sustaining type of thing, a lot less money. And we always talk about the analogies between, you know, buying your latte or whatever else you might be, frittering the money on. This is something that really is programming that comes to you and is meaningful. And it's something that provides perspective and context, not only about national issues, but about local issues. We have a very full and deep newsroom in terms of strengths and the kinds of subjects we can cover, but we need your support. You can do that by calling 454-6300, 454-6300, or go to WXXI.org.
Thank you, Randy. Okay. We'll talk to you next hour, and we continue our conversation now with our monthly science roundtable and hearing about the work that was rolled out this past Friday at the University of Rochester, their fifth annual Hey Jim Design Day at the University of Rochester. Students from various engineering backgrounds showing off what they can do. And Evan Baker's here. Evan's in studio to talk about his work in, first of all, mechanical engineering, right?
Correct.
Okay. What was your work on this for Hey Jim Design Day?
I was working with a team at Wegmans and a few other students to develop an automated temperature monitoring solution.
Temperature monitoring.
Correct.
Okay.
They have, at Wegmans, I'm sure you've seen them, you go in, they have these standalone cases where they put their prepared foods. They're, you know, about waist height, open top, and they have all these packages of prepared food in there. And the FDA has very strict regulations on the temperatures that that prepared food has to be kept at. So at the moment, they have someone going around and temping all of these food items by hand, where they take an insertion probe and they just stick it in, or if the package can't be opened, they do what's called a pack-to-pack test, where they stack them and insert the probe between the packages and get a temperature reading to make sure that it's within that FDA spec. And if it's not, they have to throw it out.
Throw out the food.
Yeah. Well, they're committed to providing, you know, safe products for their customers, and if the food spoils, somebody gets sick, that's a big problem.
Okay, and so you got hooked up with them. Did they come to you? How did this come together?
They were one of the customers that were working with us from the beginning. There were several projects that we got to choose from, and it just ended up that this was something that I was interested in. There were a few other students, and so we got together, and it worked out.
How has it worked?
Our proof of concept worked fantastically.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
So, sure. What we did was we had a RTD, which is a resistance-dependent temperature monitoring probe that we attached to the package, and then we collected the temperature data from that probe, sent it wirelessly to a cloud service where it was aggregated, and we could monitor it.
Very cool stuff. And going forward now, is it out of your hands? What happens next with this?
Well, we're presenting it to the Wegmans food safety team this week, and they really like it. They think that they can take it somewhere.
That's great stuff. Evan Baker talking about a mechanical engineering solution to a problem that that Wegmans has, and frankly, I would think anybody in grocery service would have, right?
Sure.
Absolutely. Very cool stuff. Colin Murphy, the mimic arm. What is a mimic arm?
So our mimic arm mimics the motion you make with your arm. We use motion tracking to follow basically a skeleton of your body and have our robotic arm make those same movements.
Okay. And what's the application?
The application could be something like if you have a bomb squad and you need more intuitive dexterity on your remote system, it's a lot easier and more intuitive to move your own arm than to try to move, maybe it's just a two-axis thing where you tell it where you want it in two positions and it goes there. So it could be a lot easier to use there.
So make sure I understand this correctly, because I am not a electrical and computer engineer. Let's just say hypothetically if you have a bomb squad situation and you want to maybe dismantle or at least access something, mm-hmm. you could be standing at a remote location, 30 yards away, 300 feet away, whatever it is, and a robot sent in can actually mimic your arm movements.
That's correct.
And so instead of taking what looks like a video game controller and something a little more clunky, it's got the fluidity to do. How is the fluidity of the motion?
It's fairly fluid. The motors we got we had to stay within a certain budget, but you could definitely expand it to have motors that are more smooth and are more apt to just be as noiseless, I guess, as you can. Mm-hmm. So there's no jittering or overshooting. So if it tries to go somewhere and you stop, it doesn't go past where your arm went. It would just be about as smooth as your arm is. It doesn't have the motion capture technology we have right now doesn't cheaply anyway have ways of finding your fingers, and doesn't have a high enough resolution at a reasonable price.
Okay. I've seen actual live bomb squad operations that looks like Johnny Five. I don't know if you guys, are you guys too young to know what Johnny Five is? Oh, this is so sad around here. Do you know? Evan, no? Don't know Johnny Five? Anybody at this table?
No.
Nobody. Val, engineer, you're only 25. Johnny Five, yes? Short Circuit? Is that what it was? Short Circuit. Oh, how sad. I mean, this is so sad for me. But anyway, see, look, Colin, now you can't relate to the compliment I'm giving you. You're doing something much more developed than Johnny Five that we've seen at some of this. And who was your client for this? How did this come together?
The projects in our department are a little bit differently structured than other departments. For the most part, you'll find faculty member, and in the case of Harris, they have a few sponsors where they're interested in doing a certain project, so they'll sponsor a group doing, like one of the projects was a smart elevator where it would use the elevators more efficiently. But we actually partnered up with a professor in computer science who does a lot of robotics. He's had a lot of experience with it.
Very good. Well, I have a good question for our roundtable. If you're just joining us for our monthly science roundtable, we're talking to University of Rochester engineering students who just presented their work for HeyGym Design Day this past Friday. And they are hoping that, and I think we're seeing the evidence that their work is going to be carried forward in very real ways and solving very real problems. And Jake is one of our regular listeners and probably our smartest science listener in the audience. And I hope, Jake, I'm not giving you too big a head, but it's probably true. And he writes, I wonder if your guests can share their thoughts on why this kind of practical hands-on engineering isn't more common in education. I've talked to more than a few final year electrical engineers that I wouldn't trust to screw in a light bulb. It's a good question. And I want to go around the table to Brittany, and I'll start with you. When we talk theory or application, Everybody needs theory, I guess. But do you find yourself thriving when you get a chance to apply? And how did you view your educational experience of theory versus application?
Absolutely, I really thought that the senior design project brought everything together. It was personally, I found it difficult to see the applications even in our classes, because even though they would give us examples, I'm more of a manual person, so. Mm-hmm. Having that the opportunity to finally have a hands-on experience was really great.
Kara, what do you think?
I agree that University of Rochester really emphasizes the research aspects, so we're very theoretical-based, our education is. And I think it was all building up to getting all the theory in order to be able to apply it to real-world things. So I think it was necessary, but it was also a nice opportunity and nice change to finally be able to do something relevant.
Absolutely. And do you find yourself as a student, and let's stipulate here, we've got University of Rochester students. You're about to hear from a member of the staff, distinguished member of the staff. We've got students who I know appreciate their educational experience. We're not denigrating anything. But Kara, did you ever find yourself going a little stir crazy early on in your college experience, wanting to get your hands on something?
I did a little bit, but yeah. There are also opportunities where you can seek out a lab to be able to do this real world stuff. Like that, those opportunities exist, you mm-hmm. just have to find them. But if you're just doing the normal education without doing much on the side, then you're just going to get exposed to the theory.
I think what we're talking about here, based on Jake's question, applies across educational genres, by the way. I think students, in general, theory absolutely matters, but I think that from what I have experienced, there is a great love for getting a chance to put things into practice. Evan Baker, what about you? What do you think?
I think the theory and practical education both have their place. It sort of seems to me that just learning the practical side of things would be a little bit quicker, and you would probably still be able to accomplish your job. But understanding the theory really lets you know sort of why things are happening like they are, and probably build more efficient, cheaper, safer structures.
Everybody agree with that? Is that a good analysis? Yeah. Colin, what do you think?
One of my speculations might be kind of what we mentioned earlier, that if you just do the vanilla education and don't really do anything outside of it, it's difficult for professors to sort of push the class to do practical things that are really fun, because those are a lot harder. They're a lot real world, which means you actually have to, it's not just, you know, an equation anymore. You actually have to understand what that equation means and why it's useful there. So I think it's a combination of focusing on the conceptual stuff and not having a place to really push people in, you know, the everyday student, I guess, not one that's going to go outside.
Well, let me bring in, if I could, and I'm going to bring in James Zavislin, who is the Associate Dean of Education and New Initiatives, and an Associate Professor of Optics, the Principal Organizer of Design Day, and Jim is here to help us understand not only what the university thinks about the work that we saw rolled out at HeyGym, but let me start there, Jim. When you heard the students talking about they are clearly enthusiastic about applying what they're learning. And they're not scorning the theory, but they're loving the application. How do you balance that?
Well, theory and models that are underlie engineering and applied science are the foundation. And so we teach those fundamental understandings and concepts so that students, when they do have their opportunity to be creative, they can actually go ahead and build that creativity on something that actually has lasting value. So we revert to engineering as creativity within constraints. And within that, the theory is a foundation, and the courses that they have early on give them the language to interact and have the intuition to be able to understand. The wonderful thing about the Design Day experience, and the students talk to this, is the engagement with an external customer.
Yeah.
And because of that, what happens is I think all of them probably would be able to comment on, I'll call it the challenges with working with customers. Oftentimes they have perhaps unreasonable expectations, they have understandings that perhaps don't match their own. And literally just coming to agreement on what the project is part of the process. And also the other thing that's also sometimes tough for some students is the understanding that schedules are important. There was a flurry of activity coming up to Design Day, and I think some of the students recognize that perhaps some more deliberate milestones would have been useful. But the nice thing there is at least they're doing it within a situation where they can learn from their mistakes and move forward.
Colin, what was the hardest part about working on this kind of a project where you're working with the client, you've got to match their expectations with what you create, you've got to work on a deadline? What was the hardest part for you?
I think I would agree with trying to figure out exactly what the project is and the goals and visions for each, the party making it and the customer party. I think for us, it was more about the methodology that our professor wanted us to use was very unintuitive and was not a way we were really comfortable about doing it. So overcoming that was probably the biggest challenge in that interaction.
Satisfied how it turned out?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Evan, biggest challenge for you?
I also agree that coming to an agreement about what the project is one of the most difficult parts of developing something. But I also think that, for example, in my project, we worked with an external vendor to source some of our components, and communicating with them and cooperating with them was a very challenging thing as well, because you know they have their own agenda, they're their own company, and then we need things from them, and getting them to deliver on time and exactly what we need can be a challenge as well.
Stressful?
Yes, indeed.
But you got there, right?
Yep.
Yeah, Kara, biggest challenge for you?
Well, I think it's just you have to be flexible and you have to be able to adjust your timeline. Because things keep coming up, so you have to be able to quickly adapt to whatever changes you have to make to your project. So even if you have a long-term goal in mind, getting there, you're going to get off track a little bit, and then you have to pull yourself back and finish it on time. So,
did you have late nights working on this?
Yes, a few.
Yeah, I guess that's part of what they would call real-world experience. And Brittany, you can pull that mic a little closer. Yeah, hardest part for you in dealing with this kind of a project?
Well, we were really lucky. We had very few hiccups. Our customer was very responsive. She was across the street at the medical center, so...
See, that's easier for you.
Yes.
Evan is looking with some jealousy across the table.
I mean, I only had to go down the road to Wegmans headquarters, so it wasn't too much of a...
But what about your external vendor, for example?
Oh, they're across the country.
Okay, see, that's a little different. A little different.
Yeah, so it was very easy to just walk over, and she was very responsive, so that was really lucky. I guess that one of the issues was that there were specific components in our device, and we'd think, oh, that'd take us 3 weeks to do, and one of the components actually took us the entire semester to finally nail. And then other components, like, took much less time than we expected. So it was, you expect one idea and something completely different happens. So that was a learning experience.
Did the deadline that you had, was it artificial in any way because you're still students? In other words, if you're engineering solutions outside of an educational setting, would you have been able to push things back in any way? Did any of you feel that you had to speed up just to get done by a deadline?
Well,
go ahead, Evan.
I feel like Design Day is a very real hard deadline, because once you hit it, you know, then you're done. You graduate and you don't have any more time. You can't push the deadline any. Whereas in a real world situation, you're working for a company, maybe you can get an extra week or two. But we didn't have that.
I guess that makes you very good about finishing it. And Professor Zvislin?
Actually, deadlines do matter all the time. One of the phrases I have is the FedEx dude comes at 5. And sometimes you have to make that deadline or the product doesn't ship and you lose an opportunity. So we do make these deadlines hard, because most businesses really rely on predictable schedules in order to be profitable.
I think that's well said. You're getting no disagreement from the students here. And so let me wrap up with this then. Colin and Kara, I'll kick to you guys here. Most valuable aspect of this project is you're headed to Duke now. It looks like you're on a great trajectory. What did you get out of this experience?
I guess what I took away was it was a very real world experience. I was able to interact with a customer and figure out how all that works, how a project goes from start to finish, and how it progresses, and the obstacles that you face along the way, basically, and how you overcome them.
Colin?
I think for me it would be branching out into something I hadn't really done before. I've focused more on electrical, computer engineering, and a little bit of computer science. So being able to do stuff in robotics with my other group members knew much, much more than I did about robotics. So I was able to take quite a bit from that.
By the way, I hear robotics more often than I ever have at younger educational settings, more robotics clubs and whatnot. Anybody here take in a robotics? No? Did you, Colin, you weren't growing up?
No.
Very interesting.
One of my team members did do, have you heard of FIRST Robotics? It's a high school competition. I heard they changed it quite a bit, but it's, as far as I know, is that nationwide?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. So, well, I mean, I think it just, to me, best I can tell, it's part of the effort to bring more young people into careers and ideas like this, but look what you did. You didn't even have that background, and great work. Colin Murphy, Evan Baker, Kara Lamson, Brittany Kilcher, thank you all for being here, sharing your success stories, not only with HAGEM Design Day last Friday, but also going forward as we talk about the way engineering can be applied to real-life scenarios. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Professor Zavislin. Great to see you. Thank you. And great work from the University of Rochester. This has been our monthly Science Roundtable. Short break, and we're going to get you up to date on the breaking news we've had from Albany today and from Manhattan as well, with New York. The Southern District U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara announcing those charges against Dean Skelos and his son, the majority leader of the New York State Senate. So that, the New York SAFE Act, much more next hour.